Tom Hall. This is the Midday Health Watch. Senate leadership wants to replace the Affordable Care Act with the Better Care Reconciliation Act. As of this moment, passage of the Senate health care bill appears somewhat in doubt. Majority Leader Mitch McConnell has reportedly warned President Trump and fellow Republicans that if it fails, he may have to negotiate with Chuck Schumer. Heaven forbid. Yesterday's CBO score and a chorus of critics say the Senate bill will cause at least 15 million Americans to lose their health insurance next year. On today's edition of Health Watch, our monthly conversation with Baltimore City Health Commissioner Dr. Lena Wen, we'll talk about the impact the Senate bill might have on our city's most vulnerable populations and the ongoing fight to quell the growing opioid epidemic. Dr. Lena Wen in the house. Midday starts right after these headlines. And welcome, everybody. I'm Tom Hall. Very glad you're with us. Today, it's the Midday Health Watch. The Senate version of healthcare legislation is the topic on most people's minds these days on Capitol Hill and elsewhere. The horse trading is in full swing on a bill that Majority Leader Mitch McConnell crafted with just a handful of senators. The number of Republicans who are wavering or who have announced outright opposition hovers at around six. McConnell can afford only three Republican defections, and he is still insisting that a vote be taken this week before the July 4th recess. So it remains to be seen whether or not that will happen. It also remains to be seen what effect passing the bill would have on patients, doctors, hospitals, insurers, and public health agencies, although there are plenty of people from each of those groups who have criticized McConnell's so-called discussion draft of the bill. Barack Obama cited its fundamental meanness, and President Trump bristled at the fact that Obama had borrowed that descriptor from Trump's own assessment of the House bill. He actually complained that he, Trump, was the first to call it mean, as if he deserves special credit or something. I'm not quite sure what that's all about. But the most contentious aspect of both the House and Senate versions are the deep cuts to Medicaid expansion. Today on the Midday Health Watch, Dr. Lena Wen, the health commissioner of the city of Baltimore, can help us understand what passing something like the legislation that Senator McConnell is suggesting would mean for the most vulnerable folks living in our city who rely on programs like Medicaid to survive. And what will it mean for efforts to counter the epidemic of opioid addiction? What will it mean for children and the elderly and for people who are insured even through their employers? You can join our conversation at 410-662-8780, our email midday at WIPR.org, and our Twitter handle at midday. Tom Hall. Lena, it's nice to see you.
Nice to see you, Tom.
So first, I want to get a pregnancy update. You're expecting a baby in just a couple of months. How you feeling? You look great.
Oh, thank you. I feel larger every time I come in and speak with you. The heat is rather difficult, but I feel great.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Good for you. And you're due in August, so we will, of course, going to continue to wish you all the best with that. So the CBO, Congressional Budget Office, came out with the scoring of the Senate version of a bill. It's interesting, you know, when the House bill passed back in March, went to the Senate, and so many people, even on the Republican side, said, oh, this thing's dead on arrival. We're going to start from scratch. But as you look at this version of the bill, which they're calling the Better Care Reconciliation Act, so they've got a new name. Do you see any particular difference between this bill and the House bill? And there are, of course, some pretty substantial differences between either of those bills and the ACA. What's your first reaction to the impact that this bill would have were it to pass?
My first reaction is that I'm disturbed every time I read the news. And it's because I hear descriptors that are not even accurate. I mean doesn't come close to describing what the House or Senate versions actually do. I mean, we're not talking about politics or strategies, which is what I hear in the news. This is about people's lives. I mean, the fact that there are 22 million people, as deemed by the CBO, who are going to lose insurance, and many more who are going to end up having bare bones plans that actually don't cover their basic health needs. I mean, when I think about what that means for everyday people, certainly for our most vulnerable individuals who already are at the brink and really depend on the safety net. But it's not just these individuals. We're also talking about half of all the pregnant women who depend on Medicaid. We're talking about more than 85,000 children in Baltimore City alone who depend on Medicaid. We're talking about older adults, two-thirds of individuals who use nursing homes, two-thirds of nursing home care relies on Medicaid. We're also talking about prescriptions and eyeglasses and hearing aids. I mean, these are core services, basic services that people need that are going to be affected and really literally stripped away if these bills were to pass. I'm so bothered by this because I've seen what happens when people go without access to healthcare, when they make these very difficult choices. They're not hypotheticals, as some of the news might be saying. These are things that I've seen working in the ER. I remember seeing my patients forego their medications for heart problems, forego their medications for diabetes. And our system is perverse in that if somebody comes in and they're extremely ill, so somebody comes in with sepsis, they have an all-over body infection, they have a leg infection that even requires their leg to be amputated, we can treat those issues. And we do a good job of treating these issues, but why don't we think about what we could have done to prevent these infections from happening in the first place, from that diabetes from getting to the point where somebody needs to get to be on dialysis or to have a leg amputation? This is what we are going to end up having if this bill were to pass. So we're going to stop our emphasis on prevention and instead focus on these extremely expensive acute care treatments and also deny people of the right to life and the right to health.
So your reading of these two bills, the House and Senate versions, is that it does back away from preventive care and concentrates on acute care in crisis situations. That's one way of you know, generally summarizing what's in this legislation.
Well, we know that these bills will, in fact, strip funding for prevention. There is $1 billion that's going to be taken away from preventive efforts at the state and local level. And these are efforts to do things like provide immunizations for our children and prepare us for emergencies and outbreaks. I mean, that's one example of how, even though it seems like we're saving money, we're saving $1 billion, it's going to cost us a lot more down the line when our children are unhealthy, when we're not able to control our outbreaks. The other thing, too, is these bills will strip away the protections for essential health benefits. They're called
things
essential
like
health
maternity
benefits.
Maternity care, mm-hmm. emergency room care, hospitalization. This is what, you know, comes under this rubric of essential health benefits.
That's right. And they're called essential health benefits for a reason. These are essential. I mean, nobody plans to get sick. Nobody plans to be in the ER. Nobody plans to be in a car accident. And it doesn't make sense to even buy a health insurance plan that doesn't cover hospitalizations. Preventive care is actually also under these essential health benefits. And so if we are to cut the very definition of essential health benefits, we're not going to be incentivizing prevention. And if we have now millions of people who are going to become uninsured, these are individuals who will have to make a choice every day between going to see the doctor now for a small problem or paying for their food or rent. And I think most people will decide to pay for other life necessities, including caring for our families, and therefore allow these small problems to fester into much bigger problems that end up costing society a lot more down the line, not to mention that it's unethical for us to watch someone get sicker when there was something that we could have done to prevent them from getting there.
Dr. Lena Nguyen is the health commissioner of the city of Baltimore. I'm Tom Hall. It's the Midday Health Watch, 410-662-8780, our email midday@wypr.org. So 8 or 9 years ago when Obamacare was being crafted, it seems that if I might indulge in a little of huge oversimplification, that the Mr. Obama's thrust was insuring as many people as possible. We had something like the number that was bandied about back in that day was like 40 million people that didn't have health insurance. Emergency rooms were being overrun. People were being billed for their emergency room care, and they were going bankrupt because of it. We had, you know, story after story of that. So the thrust of the Democratic Party's approach to health care, because none of the Republicans voted for it, was insure as many as you can and then figure out how to make that affordable in some way or another. You know, the Republicans, you know, perhaps Speaker Ryan or Leader McConnell would say, okay, that's important. We want to insure as many as we can. However, it's a sixth of the nation's economy, and the cost really matters a lot. Perhaps it matters more to Mr. McConnell, Mr. Ryan, and Mr. Trump than it did to Mr. Obama. I mean, people talk about the right to health care. If I could have you wax philosophical for a second here. people have, if you accept the fact, the notion that people have a right to health care, does it follow or does it precede, perhaps, that people have the right to health insurance? I mean, is the only way people can get health care is if they are insured in some government in a program by the government that's overseen. That seems to me sort of in broad terms where the demarcations are. But the AMA has came out, the American Medical Association come out opposing this bill, saying that it breaks the first rule that you all take as the Hippocratic Oath, do no harm. What do you think? I mean, is it a right for American citizens to be insured?
Nobody plans to be sick. And I think it's important for us to think about this, that all of us as Americans or as people want the same thing for us and for our loved ones. We don't want to get sick, but if we do happen to require healthcare services, we want to have the ability to get quality care that doesn't bankrupt us and that allows us to find out what we have and to get treated and to be better. I reject this notion of choice because it is not a choice to get sick. I also reject the notion that some people will put forth saying, well, some of these health benefits, some of these essential health benefits are choices that we make. You make the choice to get preventive care. But actually, that choice is what's going to save us money down the line. Or people will say, well, it's a choice to be pregnant. Although the same individuals who value life and value the choice, the quote-unquote choice of being pregnant, are also the ones who are trying to cut reproductive health services through cutting Planned Parenthood and other services too. So that choice, we have to recognize, is predicated on privilege. Choice is also predicated on the opportunities that some of us may have over others. And so to your point about what is this right, that right should be a right to basic services. These are not services that should depend on what state we happen to live in or what plan we can afford. I mean, we have to be honest with ourselves that rationing is occurring now. But right now, rationing is occurring based on our ability to pay. And all of us as Americans should reject that. I also want to add that there's something problematic, too, about the approach of saying, well, these plans are going to save money down the line. They're not, because we should not just be looking at the cost of a program. We should also be looking at the cost of doing nothing. If we wait until somebody's very ill and now they require ICU care for multiple days and require surgery instead of getting antibiotics to start with, I mean, that's something that we should take into account as well. We can't just be looking at the cost of this program right now without thinking about the cost to society in terms of economic loss of productivity and also in terms of our moral obligation to provide care for all of our citizens.
Dr. Lena Nguyen is the Baltimore City Health Commissioner. We're going to have more of the Midday Health Watch when we come back from a quick break. You can join our conversation 410-662-8780, our email midday at WIPR.org. If you want to join us on Twitter, that would be grand. At Midday, Tom Hall is where you should find us. We'll be right back. Stick around.
This is your public radio, WIPR.
And welcome back. It's midday. I'm Tom Hall. By the way, coming up tomorrow on the program, a conversation about the different habits of people in different generations and how those differences can affect the workplace and the marketplace. Chuck Underwood studies such things, as does Crystal Kadakia. She's the author of Millennial Myth, Transforming Misunderstanding into Workplace Breakthroughs. So that's coming up on midday tomorrow. So if you work in a multi-generational workplace, you'll want to tune in. And even if you don't, you'll want to tune in, so you'll be smart. And if you're just joining us today, it's the Midday Health Watch. It's our monthly chat with Dr. Lena Nguyen, the Health Commissioner of Baltimore. Our phone number, 410-662-8780. Our email, midday@wypr.org. You can follow us on Twitter, @MiddayTomHall. Let's take a couple of phone calls. Heidi in Columbia, welcome to Midday with Dr. Nguyen.
Hi, thank you so much for taking my call. I'm a critical care physician in Baltimore, and I couldn't agree more with Dr. Nguyen's description of how we oftentimes see the natural history of disease present itself, catastrophically to the emergency room and the ICU. I just wanted to add one thing. Oftentimes, our most vulnerable population, their fundamental issues in addition to their health, is really their diet and housing that has led to worsening healthcare issues. And so I'm really curious what Dr. Nguyen's thoughts are on healthcare sort of taking a more holistic approach to the management of our patients and our really our citizens in the genre of preventing this. Thank you.
All right. Thank you for your call, Heidi. Dr. Nguyen?
I also could not agree more with Heidi. What she just mentioned is the core of public health, that the health of our population is not just dependent on health care, the care that we get in a hospital, but is dependent on conditions all around us. I mean, that actually explains why it is that we have a 20-year difference in life expectancy in Baltimore City, depending on what neighborhood you happen to live in. We have access to health care, but just being close to a hospital doesn't mean that we're going to have a longer life or better quality of life. That actually depends on all the other factors, including there's a strong correlation with poverty. Unfortunately, there are correlations with race, there are correlations with geography, and other issues like food and transportation. These social determinants of health very much play into it. And I know that working as an emergency physician, I'm often troubled by the hypocrisy that we exhibit in our healthcare system. I can tell a patient all I want that she should eat healthier foods in order to treat her heart disease. But if she tells me that she lives in a food desert where she has to take two buses and then walk 10 blocks to get groceries, where the closest thing she has to a healthy, to have healthy food near her is a corner store with a dried old banana and a bag of chips. I mean, you know, there is a hypocrisy to what we do in healthcare, and we have to recognize that healthcare needs to go beyond the four walls of a hospital. That, in fact, is what public health is all about. But I think it also underscores why we cannot talk about this narrative of choice and only as choice, because that what is that choice for my patient with heart disease? What is the choice for a young child who's born into an environment where he has asthma because in part of all the environmental triggers around him? And so these are all the other issues that we have to tackle. And again, why a bill like the Senate and House versions are really detrimental, because it's taken us in the wrong direction. It's rolling back the gains that we have already made through the ACA in order to start improving access to healthcare and addressing some of these social determinants.
Dave in Annapolis, welcome to Midday with Dr. Nguyen. And I think you want to pick up on this theme of choice and what people's personal responsibility and choice making is all about. Thanks for your call.
Sure. The only comment I had was in countering the doctor's comment where you're saying about getting sick isn't a choice. No, it's not a choice. But getting in a wreck is not a choice either, and yet you got to have car insurance, because when you're out there in public driving a vehicle, you could hit somebody, you could cause some damage to or to yourself. You have to have that. That's part of being in a working society. We can't cover everybody. You'll never be able to cover everybody. And don't think I'm heartless, because there are certain people in society that we absolutely have to cover because they have no choice mentally or financially. I get it. You got to cover those folks. But for the rest of the population, this notion that we've got to cover everything for everybody is ridiculous. When you're in this life, You do the best you can to get a decent job or provide some income and buy your health insurance. And if everybody had health insurance and you had a large enough pool to cover that, the prices would come down just by volume, and we wouldn't need to bolster everybody up. So I disagree with her notion. That's it.
All right, well, thanks for the call, Dave.
I actually don't disagree with Dave in that you're articulating why it is that insurance works. Insurance works if it's not just the individuals who are unhealthy and have many conditions and require a lot of treatment. Insurance works is if we're all in this together, including the healthy individuals who don't require a lot of care. And that's why I take particular issue with the Senate and House versions, which remove the individual mandate that requires individuals to get health insurance. And what is happening as a result of that is healthcare becomes more expensive, and we are now removing protections for our poor and middle-class Americans and instead redistributing the savings to wealthy people. I mean, ultimately, this is something that's going to hurt children, working families, older adults, and we should be going the opposite direction. We should be incentivizing everyone to get health insurance and providing for others who are unable to pay for it, because ultimately those costs are still going to be passed down to all of us in the form of more expensive health care.
When people talk about tweaking the ACA and improving the existing law, they often point to the fact that the penalties for not purchasing insurance under the individual mandate are not harsh enough. Last year, I guess about $5.1 billion was spent in penalties. Kellyanne Conway, a senior advisor to the president, said, you know, if that $5.1 billion were spent on health care, it would be better, right? So I don't think anybody would disagree with her. However, the Senate and the House version abandon the individual mandate. The House version has something called continuous coverage or creditable coverage, and that's if you've gone without insurance for 63 consecutive days in a 12-month period, then you get some sort of penalty. And in the Senate version, which I really don't understand, perhaps you can explain this to me, you have to wait 6 months before you could buy insurance. So that's another 6 months where you're going without insurance. So that's an anti-incentive, it seems to me. That particular provision of the bill just doesn't make sense. The House bill, again, doesn't have a waiting period, but it requires insurers to increase premiums by 30%. So you do get a premium penalty when you finally do go back. But in your view, is the penalties under the ACA enough? Are they substantial enough? And if not the penalties, is there another way of increasing this pool? Because the pool size seems to be at the fundamental problem that we're dealing with. The costs are going up because the pool is just filled with people who require too many services.
It is true that we have to increase the size of the pool. The whole point of the individual mandate is to say that we're all in this together, right? Insurance works if we're all in this. By taking out the individual mandate, the House and Senate have tried to come up with other ways to discourage people from dropping out of insurance, and the continuous coverage provision is part of that. The problem is it's going to end up hurting the individuals who are ill, and it's going to end up hurting individuals who are those who we have the greatest responsibility to provide for, including older adults. I mean, studies have shown that it's low-income older adults who are going to be affected the most, including now paying up to 5 times more than other individuals. We're also going to end up hurting children. I mean, these are things that don't make sense. What sense does it make for us to deny our children access to things like immunizations, dental care? What sense does it make for us to also cut corners and provide savings by essentially having such bare bones plans that people don't need them? I mean, if you have cancer, you're not going to buy a plan that doesn't include chemotherapy and radiation treatment. And yet that is what is happening in this effort to get rid of the individual mandate and still save money. Those are the corners that are having to be cut as a result of all these different compromises. And at this point, it does not make sense. I'm not saying that the ACA was perfect. There are many tweaks to be made in the ACA. But to say that we should roll back all the gains that have been made to instead bleed those individuals who are the most vulnerable and to cut care for everyone else. It just doesn't make sense.
You study this. You pay a lot of attention to this. Is there a solution to increasing the pool that the data shows that you've run across that you think is a good idea? If some version of the individual mandate or some version of the high-risk pools that Congressman Ryan talks about? Or I mean, what does the data show to your understanding would be an ideal way or a better way of having more people having the incentive to be in the market?
The things that would reduce cost and improve coverage are what the ACA has already been trying to do. First, increasing subsidies for those who are in need. Second, expanding the eligibility for Medicaid. And third, the individual mandate. All of these things are important for us to get everyone in. And that, again, is something that will keep our population healthier and actually reduce cost for everyone else down the line.
So a mandate is the way to go at some under some form or fashion, but perhaps harsher penalties for people who don't sign up?
There will need to be some version of the individual mandate to ensure that we can actually have everyone in while at the same time being cognizant that we don't want to price people out and that the plans that we provide need to be comprehensive enough and have these essential health benefits that people actually need in order to get better health.
Dr. Lena Wen, who is the Baltimore City Health Commissioner, 410-662-8780 is our number here at the Midday Health Watch. Our email, midday@wipr.org. If you want to follow us on Twitter, @MiddayTomHall. We have a few tweets. This is from Ermgard, who says, the other issue that is that some in Congress think that jobs must be attached to health insurance, but few jobs pay living wages. Byron tweets that now the GOP has no choice but to repeal rather than fix the ACA. They've promised that red meat to their constituents. This debate has nothing to do with health care. It's only about winning. So there is, of course, this political dimension to health care policy. You see health care from the perspective of a physician in an ER or a public health commissioner who's dealing with large groups of people who have very serious challenges that they're facing. There are folks in Congress who, you know, they're in charge of running our government, and they've got to see it in terms of dollars and cents and also in terms of political victories. But boy, when those things are all intertwined all the time, it's tough to have a reasonable conversation about it, isn't it?
That's why it's important for us to focus on what this means at the end of the day. For me, this is not about partisanship. It's about people's lives. I mean, we're talking about an individual whom, let's say, they have a substance use disorder. They have addiction to opioids. This individual, if they are to lose health care insurance today, their only option may be to go out onto the streets, use drugs, overdose, and maybe even die. I mean, I can see the faces of my patients I've treated who waited to get health care, not because of some choice that they made, but because they were forced into those situations. And that's what it's about at the end of the day. We can't just talk about a policy or a talking point. We have to think about what it means for everyday people.
Jim is calling from the Eastern Shore. Jim, welcome to Midday with Dr. Wen.
Hi, thank you. If you've got about 2 minutes, I've got the problem and two solutions for you.
Well, I'll give you a minute and a half. How's that?
Okay, the problem is that the very first part of the bill is cutting the taxes that they passed to pay for Obamacare. That's the political necessity that has to be answered, and that's something that will never be taken out of this bill, and they've got to therefore generate enough money to pay back for all the taxes that they're cutting for the wealthy. The second problem is that the bill itself, like the first bill, doesn't do anything to solve the real problem, the cost of medicine, the cost of doctors, the cost of hospitals, and the cost of prescriptions. And everybody knew that, and nobody has done anything about it. The solution is that if we went to single payer, in other words, what's down at the end of the road, like every other developed nation, you could eliminate what the insurance industry gets. It costs Medicaid about 5% on the dollar to pay for the administrative costs. the insurers are allowed to take 20%. If you eliminated that 20%, you'd probably generate enough cash available to pay for the people who aren't insured now. So I wish you'd tackle with all three of those.
All right. Well, thank you for the call, Jim. Appreciate it. So the question is, what's wrong with people who have comfortable incomes paying taxes to subsidize the health care for people who aren't working or don't have incomes or are disabled or who are children? I mean, why should people with comfortable incomes pay for insurance for all these other people?
Because my health also depends on your health, because costs are going to be paid, even if they're paid down the line, they're still going to be paid by all of us in some way. And ultimately, we have to decide as a society, do we have an obligation to each other? Do we have an obligation to care for those who are the most vulnerable and to provide for not only them, but also to ensure the health and well-being and the futures of generations that are yet to come? I think it's a philosophical question, but one that I actually think the majority of Americans believe that there is a fundamental right, and maybe right is too political of a term, but a fundamental need for us to ensure health and well-being for everyone, because that's what we all want at the end of the day. Forget the term ACA or talking about repeal or replace. When there are opinion polls and studies of what it is that Americans want, we really do want the same thing. We don't want to worry about going bankrupt by being in a car accident. We don't want our children to grow up unhealthy. We understand that mental health is just as important as physical health and that both should be provided for. These are core concepts, and I hope that we'll keep our values in mind as we go about these conversations. And certainly I hope that the senators who are deciding on this important issue will keep in mind the views and preferences of their residents when it comes to very basic fundamental concepts in their conversations.
And one of the values that the people on the political right would point to is the value of the market, that the markets are part of our capitalist American tradition, and that they are in many ways one of the most effective ways to, you know, cull the herd and make things work efficiently and cost effectively. So if the market is one of the values that's going to inform an approach to the healthcare industry. We didn't used to have a healthcare industry. We used to have health insurers. You know, that's something that was actually created by doctors. I mean, doctors were the ones who said, let's put together this group of folks who can, help us get paid. This goes way back. I mean, and I'm by no means an expert on this, but if the value of the marketplace is still elevated in this discussion, do you see from your perch, from your experience in the ER and as a public health official, you know, any way that in fact the market can work to take care of the people who need to be taken care of? Or is Jim simply making the point that so many have made before, that the only way to do it is get rid of the market, have a single payer system where there is no competition, and then, you know, end of story?
The market could work if there are conditions in place to enable it to, including definition of essential services that need to be provided, then we can have different types of plans with different deductibles and co-pays, but these basic services need to be included. The market can also work if we have incentives that are aligned, so that we should not just be incentivizing really expensive acute care, but maybe we should be incentivizing providing of housing, providing of transportation and food and these other factors too. And ultimately, we as a society have to decide, are we okay with the idea of denying people access to healthcare based on their ability to pay? I think that's the ultimate question that we as a country, we as citizens have to decide on. I, of course, as a physician and as a public health official, think that that is unconscionable, that it's denying people access to life. But that is the conversation that we as a community need to be having.
And it is the conversation we will continue after we take a quick break. Dr. Lena Nguyen is the health commissioner for the city of Baltimore. She joins us every month for the Midday Health Watch. And by the way, we'll have links to the Be More Healthy blog, where Dr. Nguyen often writes about public health issues. We'll link you there at wipr.org/ midday. Our conversation will continue, 410-662-8780, our email midday@wipr.org, or Twitter handle @MiddayTomHall. Stick around.
This is WYPR.
Welcome back. I'm Tom Hall. If you've just joined us, it's the Midday Health Watch. Late yesterday afternoon, the Congressional Budget Office released its scoring of the Senate version of the bill to replace the ACA, or Obamacare. They call it the Better Care Reconciliation Act. And we're talking about what some people are calling Trump care and related health issues with Dr. Lena Wen, the health commissioner of Baltimore. You can join our conversation at 410-662-8780, our email midday@wipr.org, to follow us on Twitter @MiddayTomHall. And by the way, to get your information directly from our health commissioner, you can follow the Baltimore Health Department @BeMore_Healthy on Twitter and @DrLenaWen. Let's talk a little bit about funding for the opioid crisis. Mm-hmm. A magazine called STAT polled experts at 10 universities, folks who are experts in public health, to speculate about the arc of the opioid epidemic nationally over the next 10 years. And the conclusion is very frightening. They're saying that the death toll from opioid addiction could top 650,000 people in the next decade. That means opioids could kill nearly as many people in the coming decade as HIV/AIDS has killed in the United States since the early 1980s. The scope of this epidemic is something that we've talked about it a lot, you know, in your visits. But boy, oh boy, and it ain't getting any better by a long shot.
No, in fact, it's getting worse. I'm glad that we're recognizing that this is an epidemic. I just wish that we would have as much urgency as if this were any other illness. Imagine if there were projected 650,000 people to die from Ebola in the coming decade. I mean, that would be astounding, and we would absolutely be rallying every resource to be able to fight it. And yet, when I look at our data for 2016 in Baltimore City alone, there are two people a day who died from overdose, two people a day, more than the number that died from homicide or car accident or suicide. And this is something that we have to address right now. And what's so frustrating to me is that we know what works. It's different from other epidemics, perhaps, or other diseases where we may not have a treatment, we may not have a vaccine. In this case, we actually know how to prevent it, and we know how to save someone's life at the point that they're overdosing and how to treat them longer term, too. It's extremely frustrating that we have the ability to save people's lives, but we don't have the resources to do so. In Baltimore alone, in the last 2 years, as a result of our blanket prescription and our aggressive outreach and training, everyday residents have saved now over 950 lives. This is our most recent count. Everyday residents, neighbors, have saved over 950 of other neighbors, community members. And it's because we've gotten Narcan or Naloxone, the antidote, into as many people's hands as possible. But we are limited in how many more people we're able to get this medication to because we're simply out of money. We simply don't have the money to purchase as much Narcan as we need. We're having to ration our supply of Narcan. We also don't have nearly enough treatment, even though we know that treatment works, that there is recovery that is possible, but we don't have nearly enough funding for treatment. And it's extremely frustrating when we know, when we can see our goal, we see the North Star, we know how to get there, but we just don't have the resources to save lives while there are two people a day dying.
Let me play a little clip from last week when Clay Stamp appeared with our colleague Sheila Cast on The Record. He's the director of the Opioid Operation Command Center. You were on that same program, although you and Mr. Stamp were not on concurrently. That's the governor's opioid task force. Here's a little bit of what he had to say last week with Sheila.
The monies are available July 1. And of course, after the July 1st, the process to distribute those funds will be engaged. And so we're looking at both the CURES grant funding, which is $10 million for 2 years, and the monies that the governor put in for $10 million a year for the next 5 years. With the two funds, we're looking at accomplishing the tasks that were set forth for us by the legislature in the HOPE Act.
So we've got the HOPE Act, the Cures Act, and he's saying the money's going to start flowing July 1. What do you think?
That's Saturday, by the way. Well, I'm very glad that the governor has declared a state of emergency. I'm very glad that there are a total of $70 million that are available, apparently, for use for this epidemic. I continue to urge the state to not wait, to not wait. There are two people a day dying in our city. We know what works. We have already made many proposals to our state partners on how we can alleviate this issue.
But it's so confusing to people to hear there's $70 million waiting to be spent, and you tell people that you're rationing Narcan.
That's right.
It just doesn't make sense. You know, how do people get their arms around that?
Well, that's what we're saying. We cannot let, in a state of emergency, we cannot let perfect be the enemy of the good. We know what works. We have already in the city been convening all of our partners and law enforcement and public health and our hospitals. We made many proposals to the state on how that money should be allocated. We also are continuing to urge our state partners to allocate those resources based on severity. Baltimore City represents over one-third of all the overdoses in the entire state of Maryland, and based on disparities. I mean, based on disease severity, this is how funds are allocated in a public health emergency. And we look forward to further working with the state to ensure that that money is spent in a timely fashion to jurisdictions with the highest need, and again, to really act with the urgency and compassion that this disease requires.
So last week, I guess, the Department of Health and Mental Hygiene released the state overdose numbers for 2016. They are terrifying. Opioid-related deaths up 70% in 2016 from 2015. I mean, this is just skyrocketing. And as you say, if this were some other disease, if everybody had a, you know, if there was 70% more heart attacks all of a sudden, people would be doing something. You issued a new standing order for opioid overdose reversal medication, this Narcan naloxone. You did this at the beginning of the month. Tell us what that's about. How is this different from the previous standing order? What does that standing order mean for people, and how will that help address this?
In October of 2015, I issued a standing order so that anyone who goes through a training can immediately get Narcan. They don't have to go to their own doctor to get a prescription for it, but it's still required.
You essentially prescribed it.
That's right.
You were like the doctor. You are the doctor for the city, and you said, here's a prescription. Everybody gets it.
Exactly. But it's still required that you have to show proof of a training. Now, I strongly believe in training. I think training is good if you're able to do it. And we do trainings everywhere. We have it online at don'tdie.org. We also have trainings on street corners and markets, wherever it is that people are. But we wanted to remove that further administrative barrier. And so the standing order that I issued on June 1st is essentially to make naloxone or Narcan over the counter so that anyone can now walk into any of our pharmacies here in the city and get Narcan without a prescription and without showing that they've gone through the training. And we still have the trainings available, but we want to get this medication into as many hands as possible. And I would encourage anyone listening to go to their pharmacy and get it. If you are on Medicaid, you can get Narcan for a dollar. If you can't pay, it's free. Otherwise, the copay depends on what kind of insurance you have. Problem that we encounter is that we as the city, when we're trying to get Narcan into people's hands, it wouldn't seem fair to have people use their own insurance in order for them to carry Narcan to save someone else's life. I mean, we would never make a firefighter buy their own fire hose in order to save someone else's life. And so that's why we're out of funding. We get calls, dozens of calls a week from nonprofits, from community leaders, from faith leaders saying that they want to have Narcan themselves because they've seen people overdose in their facilities or around them.
But if they go into the Rite Aid or the CVS or the Walgreens and say, I'd like some Narcan, I wonder if their insurance company, who will pay for it, you know, whatever they do the copay, might say, oh, here's this person getting Narcan. I mean, maybe that person's rates could be affected, right? I mean, is that a possible unintended consequence?
With the insurance system, the healthcare system that we have currently now, there is no penalty for getting Narcan, especially with my standing order, meaning that you give it to someone other than yourself. It's still, though, a burden to place on individuals who want to save someone else's sure. life. And this is the reason why we want to get Narcan into everyone's hands. And while there are two people a day who are dying, we should not be rationing when these resources, that $70 million, is actually available.
Let me ask you another thing. The Baltimore Police Department, a few weeks ago, sometime this spring, there was a person who was having an opioid crisis at the Penn North subway station. And there's a police department policy that treats those situations, the scenes of those situations, as crime scenes or as, you know, scenes that need to be investigatory scenes. And evidently, there was a Transit Administration police officer at Penn North who prevented bystanders from assisting the man and giving him Narcan. So this seemed to have to do with a police department policy. What's the latest on that? Has that policy been changed? I mean, how can that situation be avoided in the future?
We've been working with the police department and all of our partners to recognize that first and foremost, this is about saving lives. And we are working with them to develop and implement policies accordingly. I will say that it is a combined effort ultimately for public safety and public health to work hand in hand, because there is both a supply issue as well as a demand issue. We have to reduce the supply of drugs, especially things like fentanyl that's many times stronger than heroin, is now being mixed in with heroin and is killing a lot of our residents. Actually, the number of people dying from fentanyl in our city has increased by 35 times. 35 times, not 35%, but 35 times in the last 3 years. We absolutely have to address supply, but we also have to address demand. And the demand is what we in public health work on, because unless we're able to get people treatment for the disease of addiction, we're going to continue to fuel supply.
Let's try to go to the phone for a quick comment from Ashley in Baltimore. Welcome to the show with Dr. Nguyen.
Thank you. Thank you for accepting my call. I just like to make a comment. I agree with the doctor. Healthcare is the only reason why, and having good access to good insurance is the only reason why I'm alive today. I got diagnosed with non-Hodgkin's lymphoma when I was 32 years old. I cared about what I ate. I exercised 5 to 6 days a week. And when I got diagnosed, it just absolutely floored me. And just looking at the insurance statements, I only had to pay a $1,500 deductible, but the course of my treatment was hundreds of thousands of dollars.
Sure.
I got 6 rounds of chemotherapy that was $60,000 per round. And I think there's a fundamental flaw with treating health insurance like car insurance, and like if you suffer from some health condition that it is somehow your fault, and you should shoulder all the burden of the cost of that.
And how are you feeling now, Ashley?
I'm feeling great. I've actually been in remission for almost just over a year now.
God bless. That's great. Well, thanks for the call. I really appreciate it. So, Dr. Nguyen, we just have a few seconds left. I mean, it does come down to a moral judgment, doesn't it, on a certain level? I mean, the money matters, but ethically and morally, what are we going to do as a society to make sure that people aren't dying from diseases that can be treated?
We need to take the politics out of it and go back to what it's really about, which is about people's lives. It's about the obligation that we have to care for each other and for our loved ones, and to treat everyone around us as we would want our loved ones to be treated.
Well, Lena, it's always good to see you, and we look forward to seeing you next month as well.
Good to see you, Tom. Thank you.
Dr. Lena Nguyen is the health commissioner of the city of Baltimore. That's it for us today. Coming up tomorrow, we're going to talk about why different generations approach their jobs and their lives in sometimes very different ways, and what that means for people at work and in the public sphere. Generational differences is our topic tomorrow with two authors who study these kinds of things, Chuck Underwood and Crystal Kadakia. That's coming up tomorrow here on Midday. Thanks so much for listening. I really appreciate it. I'd like to thank as well Joe Squared for providing lunch. Joe Squared serves coal-fired pizzas, risotto, and local craft beers. Locations and hours at joesquared.com. I'm Tom Hall. For the entire Midday team, we do very much appreciate your tuning in. We'll see you tomorrow. Have a great day.